Welcome. This is the podcast of Care Austria with Andrea Barstorff-Hager.
So this is our Care in Action podcast, the podcast of Care Austria. Welcome to all our listeners, this time only in English language, because I have an international guest. I'm very proud that Dr. Martin Scott, he's an associate professor and researcher at the University of East Anglia in Norwich, UK, is our guest today. Hi and good morning, Martin.
Hello, thanks for having me on here.
I mentioned already that you are a professor at East Anglia University. And let me also mention briefly your key research interests, which are media freedom and international journalism and other related topics. And this conversation takes place at a special occasion for CARE International. We will release our next Forgotten Crises report, which will be released in January next year for the seventh time already. And I'm very happy and proud that Dr. Martin Scott takes his time and will talk in the next 30 minutes or so about his view on the forgotten crisis and the role that media is playing. So before we start, let me frame briefly the main result of our next report. For the scientific background about it, we are looking worldwide into the digital media and see how many quotes which humanitarian crisis gets, and there are certain criterias that build the frame for that. You can all read it in our report. And as a matter of fact, for the first time next year, we will have 10 so-called forgotten humanitarian crises only in sub-Saharan African countries. So the top three will be Angola, Malawi, and the Central African Republic. Let us look back very briefly into last year. 1 year ago, the number two forgotten crisis in our CARE report was the Ukraine, believe it or not. We released it in January 2022, and less than 4 weeks after that, the war with Russia started. And in the meantime, the war in Ukraine is the most highlighted crisis or war in the media, with more than 2 million quotes last year. So I mentioned that because this can change overnight. What's your view on the so-called forgotten humanitarian crisis? And CARE is shedding light on these. What is your view on that? Is it the right assumption from a scientific point of view that we draw to say that those crises that are not so highly highlighted in the media are the forgotten ones?
Yeah, I think so. I think what this report does so clearly is illustrate what's gone wrong with a primarily commercial model of journalism, in which you're only able to report, and you're only incentivized to report, a very small number of humanitarian crises. So as you say, Ukraine takes all the attention and maybe one or two others, and then you have this massive long tail of all these other crises that barely appear. So I think this is like the epitome, the kind of this emblem of the problem of international journalism, and the kind of the economics primarily of international journalism leads you to this these kind of shocking statistics.
I'm not a researcher and I'm not a media researcher, but from my point of view, and I have been working in the humanitarian field for more than 30 years by now, I would say that nowadays we are in multiple crises. We always have been, but it worsened, this deteriorated over the last 2 or 3 years. And we have many chronic crises that really take enormous long time. Let's talk about Syria. It's a 12th year of war in Syria. Yeah. So I think the coexistence of so many different humanitarian crises makes it impossible to keep them all in the spotlight, apart
yeah.
from the economic situation of international journalism. Even if this would be different, it would be very difficult to keep the audience, the attention of the civil societies in Europe, let's talk about Europe, on all the different things that are ongoing at the same time.
That is the case. There isn't enough capacity in any newsroom to cover all of these crises simultaneously. And I don't think that's what, I don't think that's what your report, that's not what we should take away from your report. I think it's just the extremeness of the inequality between how much the kind of most reported crises get and everything else. And so we're not asking that newsrooms align the volume of coverage to the level of unmet need. You know, that's not the ask, I don't think. The ask is that this is such an important, the level of humanitarian need, as you rightly say, is growing each year. The level of the amount, the unmet need is also growing at the same time. And this is such a catastrophe for tens of millions of human beings, and that is not being reflected in the media. And so we're not asking that every crisis gets even coverage. We're asking for a little less mass inequality in the amount of coverage that they receive.
Yeah, from the point of view of care, it is very important to highlight and to mention that this report is not seen as a critique from our side on journalism. No, it's really important for me to share that, because I'm asked that every year when we have our media conference. I'm asked, this is a fundamental criticism on our work. No, we see as one of the largest global NGOs, we see ourselves, let's put it bluntly, in the same boat, because also for us it is really, really difficult to keep the attention of the civil society and also of the other stakeholders, which in the case of care are institutional donors like the European Union or the European governments, to keep the focus on and their attention broader than the focus that is taken by the media. But this is not a critique. This is the highlighting of a problem that we all have to deal with.
Yeah, I mean, I'd agree with that. This isn't a critique of individual journalists or those who do cover humanitarian crises. I see it as a critique of the model. So you were saying a second ago that the humanitarian crises around the world are growing, becoming more chronic, and becoming interlinked. But while that's been happening, the journalistic funding model, where the business model of journalism hasn't changed. It is still the case that there is no obvious viable source of funding for international journalism, and humanitarian news about humanitarian affairs is one of the most expensive to report. Mm-hmm. It's also one of the least profitable forms of journalism. So maybe you're likely to get lower audiences, lower advertising, lower subscription, lower revenue for your journalism. So it's hit in both ways. So I always think about news of humanitarian affairs as the kind of the very most hardest hit by the failure of an economic model of journalism in general. So yeah, I agree. This isn't to blame journalists. It's to blame the model. And just another little illustration of that. Mm-hmm. So we're at the same time as CARES reports coming out, we're publishing a book about humanitarian journalists and those who do cover routinely and regularly do manage to cover humanitarian crises. And as part of that book, we did a study of 20,000 different news outlets and how many of those covered four particular humanitarian crises. And out of those 20,000 news outlets, only 12 of them covered all four of these humanitarian crises that we chose. And so that's just another illustration of, it's not the fault of individual editors making decisions, it's the cumulative effect of a model that has to generate revenue in certain kinds of ways, and you just don't get this coverage.
That sounds really interesting. Would you be so kind to tell us the title of your book for those listeners who might be interested to learn more about this interesting topic?
Yeah, thanks for asking. I guess so. The book's just called Humanitarian Journalists, and the subtitle is Covering Crises from a Boundary Zone. We're interested in. I see the book as a launching, kind of takes its starting point as CARES research and other research like it. But rather than asking about the limits of mainstream journalism and the fact that this economic model doesn't, our current journalistic economic model doesn't work for the coverage of humanitarian crisis, we're interested in studying what it could look like. Are there journalists out there who do routinely cover humanitarian crisis? And when they do cover them, do they cover them in a less formulaic, less simplistic, more contextualized way? And the short answer to that story is there's not many, but there are some. There are some news outlets and some freelance journalists and individuals within mainstream outlets who are committed to this. And so rather than only asking what's wrong with it, we're trying to imagine a better humanitarian journalism. If I may, maybe I say a word about what we found about what those journalists are like. I should also say that I'm one of three authors. My co-authors are Mel Bunce and Kate Wright. We did this work together.
Okay, we will come to that during our conversation, Martin. But I think it is really... It might be also of interest to take a minute on the fact that you are in the UK, I'm in Central Europe here in Austria. Don't you think there are some differences in the markets, if you want to call it markets, or in the civil societies, and also in the way humanitarian journalism is understood? Because you use always humanitarian journalism. I'm not so sure. Okay, I have heard it, of course, in German, but it's not such a common expression here in German-speaking countries first. And we also don't have agencies who focus only on humanitarian journalism or magazines or newspapers like in the UK. Do you think that there are fundamental differences between the UK and Central Europe situation, or is it more or less the same with local specialties?
Yeah, I think there is a relatively uniform, consistent way of covering large-scale instances of human suffering that aren't taking place in your country, and they are dictated by the kind of dominant news values. And so I think there are pretty research shows there are broad similarities between how you cover crises not in your country. They are usually pretty short term, episodic. When you do choose to cover them, it's only when they're at their peak. It's only for a short period. There's usually a kind of binary between the international response versus the local domestic response. There's a kind of external has agency, and the kind of local authorities maybe getting in the way of aid delivery, while local people are just waiting for it to be delivered. There is a template to how these things are covered, and in the book we talk more about previous research that shows that this is pretty universal. The studies in Spain, studies in the UK, studies in Germany, studies in US news outlets. If you apply mainstream journalistic norms to the coverage of large-scale humanitarian disasters in a commercial model, you often get the same story. And I think that's another part of the problem. Not just that there isn't much coverage of most crises, but that when you do cover them, you cover them through a particular lens, lens of a decontextualized lens, a simplistic lens, a lens that's not critical of the humanitarian response, of the international humanitarian response, and a lens that doesn't give enough attention to local humanitarian response. The quantitative problem, the volume of stories, isn't enough. And then there's a qualitative problem, which is the kind of this permanent charity frame of which, when a crisis does appear, that's how it appears.
This is a very interesting topic that you are tackling now, because CARE really puts it always in the focus of our own communication, that no matter what happens where, the first responders are on the ground, the local people, because they are on the ground, they know their setting, and it's the most natural thing to do to start the emergency response. But as you mentioned, that at least in the UK, and this might be true, I'm not the expert in journalism, in continental Europe, this might be true for also German-speaking news agencies that templates are used. And of course, this defines the lens how you look at quick onset emergencies, but also on chronic crises, humanitarian crises, which we face an increasing number. This is a super delicate issue. We will come back to that soon, but let's stay a little bit, spend a little bit of time on the economic model. We mentioned already that financial resources are scarce for media networks in general, and especially for humanitarian journalism. It is quite a common practice to cover part of the cost from the side of an NGO or another sponsor, so that the norm is that cost sharing is done. And of course, there is always a certain expectation, which is fully understood, from the side of the journalist that does the trip, and of course also from the NGO, in our case it is CARE, who covers part of the cost. And this creates a certain field of neutral tension. And sometimes the expectations are simply not fulfilled. How do you see the financial issue when it becomes very concrete? Is the independence of any journalist still existing, no matter who pays for the trip?
Yeah, big question, I guess. And I guess journalists and NGOs, humanitarian agencies, are very aware of these tensions. So these tensions have been there a long time.
Yes.
Behind me, I have a 3, 4, 5, 6 academic books on the topic behind me. This is a kind of well studied issue, But what I'd say is that I think journalists are very careful of their independence. They that is a central journalistic norm. They would do a lot not to be seen to be being compromised by their sources, by their funders, by who they rely on, and that's kind of at the forefront of their minds when they're doing it. However, I guess what I'd emphasise is there's a difference between that kind of very clear independence, in which you're not simply painting a positive view of the NGO that helped you get access to the to what you do, but there is a kind of blurring of the lines between how you tell the story.
Yeah.
If you are getting access to a situation through an NGO, whilst you may be very guarded about your strict editorial independence, you might tell that story in a way that reproduces the charity frame that we were just talking about. So a lot of the time there's a kind of assumption that the frame of reference when reporting on a distant disaster to your audience is a money-related one. If only I could draw further more attention to the extent of the suffering here, if only I could generate a stronger empathy from my audience for the people that I'm speaking to, that's my objective here as a journalist. And that idea that your aim is a monetary one, whether it's the government, donor governments or audiences that will give money, that is something that perhaps most, both the journalist and the humanitarian agency could both agree on. And so editorial independence hasn't necessarily been compromised in any way, but the framing has, because you're only seeing the issue in a monetary way. But whenever you report things primarily to elicit donations, you obscure other things. You obscure the role of politics. It's not the job, well, many mainstream journalists would say it's not their job to raise money for a crisis. It's their job to explain it, to highlight it, and to tell the truth about it. And that means contextualizing, historicizing. That means explaining why it's happening. What are the long-term, short-term causes? What are the issues that led to make people vulnerable in the first place? Is it linked to climate change? Is it linked to international relations? Mm-hmm. And when you adopt a charity frame, which is perhaps more likely if you're taking your lead from an NGO to get access to it, you may find yourself emphasizing those wider political issues less by adopting a charity frame. Mm-hmm.
But do you think that it is only the large NGOs or all NGOs that are the main stakeholders in it? I'm thinking now, during your comment, I was thinking, what about the public appeals that are really blurring the line, because they are a mixture of state media, government interest, plus the large NGO stakeholders. And first comment or and or question, and second from my side would be, you talk about emergencies happening outside your own country. If you think about Germany, the floodings in Germany and floodings in Europe that we saw during the last 2 years as an impact of climate change, they were also charity framed right from the beginning. So I don't want to contradict what you're saying. I just think to have the full picture, we have to be honest enough to say that this changed dramatically also in the European setting, that it is always charity framed.
Talking about emergencies
also in our own setting.
I guess what I'm interested in is, it doesn't have to be that way, but that partly emerges from often a lack of specialists, reporting on a humanitarian beat. The international humanitarian sector is a sector with its own politics, with its own tensions, with its own actors, with its own power relations inside it. And I would argue for a greater critical mass of journalistic understanding of the aid sector, so that when a non-specialist journalist is asked to report on a disaster, then the easiest frame of reference is this charity one. But if you have dedicated long-term specialist journalists whose job it is to routinely cover humanitarian affairs, then they know the pitfalls of this charity frame. They know the context, they know the background to the actors, they're better able to have an informed and subtle and qualified account of what's happening, what the role of different actors are. And that's, I guess, to come back to our book, that's should be the role of humanitarian journalists, those who sit on the boundary between both journalistic norms and humanitarian norms, often have a much better understanding of the workings of the humanitarian system and of humanitarian principles and ethics. And so often, rather than a crude, simplistic, charity-based framing of issues, you have an informed one, a subtle one. And I guess that also can make it easier to have a kind of more refined critique of the sector as well. There's often a reluctance to critique humanitarian agencies because they're doing good, and they are doing good, but that shouldn't absolve them from critique. But at the same time, you don't want a crude critique that kind of is sweeping of the whole sector. I'm thinking at the moment, for example, a couple of months ago, the New Humanitarian did a investigation on alleged sex abuse by aid workers in a UN-run South Sudan camp. Now, that's a very important story, and there are many stories like them. But to report that, you need to do it carefully. You don't want to tar the whole sector with the same brush. Mm-hmm. At the same time, you need to explain why those things happen and how they happen and what the implications are. And so you need informed, long-term, consistent journalists who are specialists in humanitarian affairs. That's how you avoid a charity frame every time. You need humanitarian journalists.
I mean, the shifting from pure charity framed journalism to a better informed one is something that also is in the interest of us as a global NGO, because our colleagues around the globe, they are all local specialists, and of course they are also aware how their countries, because often you talk about a country or even a continent in many cases, and in reality the emergency might take place in a small separated part and is not representative of a country or half a continent. So to have this closer look also would help us as a global NGO. And we are doing this report and we are having these conversations really to learn more how we could leverage also the other sort of not only journalism, but also media coverage that not sticks purely to what you call the so-called charity framing, which really has a light, I'm not a native speaker, as you might notice, but this really has a slight tone in it that is not totally positive. And you mentioned that the humanitarian system is not so well known. Yeah, that's very, very true, because specialists should talk more honest to each other. And then also the coverage should be more focused on on realities and less on what people like to hear and what people tend to believe. But we should not oversee in this quite critical discussion that financial funding is desperately needed in many, many global emergencies, and the so-called emergency framing also channels funding to places where it is desperately needed. Yeah, of course, you can do that. I'm not questioning the fact that this can be done in more realistic and more humanitarian ways. But I also don't want to hide the fact that funding for humanitarian crisis, the need, the request for it is increasing, and it gets more and more difficult to receive. I'm not talking about sufficient humanitarian funding, mm-hmm. because it never will mm-hmm. be sufficient, but the basics that are needed, this is really, really a difficult thing. Mm-hmm. And Martin, you talk in one of your publications about the fact that humanitarian media coverage triggers civil societies or politicians or stakeholders like the European Union and motivates to allocate funding, to ask for funding, and finally to channel funding. So we can't brush, and I'm not saying that you're doing that, but we can't brush the fact that we are all interested, and also the people who are in the midst of the catastrophe, they are really interested to get some funding. And no doubt about, and no secret about, the first responders and the best responders always are the local people. But without resources, their job is really difficult. So what is your take on that?
If there were 5% more funding to every crisis, the crisis would still be happening.
Yes.
And so there is no humanitarian response to there is no, there needs to be a political response to a humanitarian crisis. And so both things have to happen. There needs to be, obviously there needs to be more funding. You know, I think last year that less than 50% of the UN appeals, were only 50% funded, less than. And obviously there needs to be more funding. But if the only time we ever talk about humanitarian crises is in terms of how little money there is, then that lets political actors off the hook. Then it never gets us closer to to understanding the root causes for it. If you only discuss the recent floods in Pakistan in relation to whether more money was needed, then mm-hmm. there's no pressure on politicians to act faster in relation to climate change. So both things need to happen. And so if you only ever talk about money, then you're letting politicians off the hook. So mm-hmm. But I don't want to say that crudely, because both need to happen, and kind of neither's happening now. That's what I'd say.
Absolutely. And I think that your book about humanitarian journalists, and also the 7th edition of the CARE report about the forgotten humanitarian crises, are a very good contribution to our debate. And we don't want to let any political decision maker off the hook. But as you said, both is needed. And our publication, I can't talk about your new book, you will do that yourself, shows also the reason and the context why so many multiple crises are ongoing, and the impact of climate change is one of the key ingredients that we have to face and accept.
Yeah, if I may, just on the climate change point, I think there's a really strong analogy there, because journalistic norms don't lend themselves to climate change coverage very well. Climate change is a distant, grand, broad, scientific, long-term issue, and all those things make it hard to be newsworthy. So for a long time, journalists failed to do climate journalism mm-hmm. justice, because, well, you know, it's just hard to get on the front page. And so, but the gravity of the situation of climate, the climate catastrophe our planet faces, is forcing journalists to reevaluate what they consider newsworthy. worthy to be, and to, you know, commitments to cover climate change every day, for example. And the same is true for the interlinked humanitarian catastrophes the world currently faces. It is surely no longer tenable to only have just a smattering of news stories about chronic humanitarian crises that affect tens of millions of people. That must also, just like climate change, should make us question what news is. The scale of human suffering and the scale of unmet need must also confront journalists and say, are the current criteria we use to decide what is newsworthy, are they sufficient to reflect the reality of the world around us? And I don't think they are.
And you already gave the answer that they are definitely not. And in the top three of our next report, as I already mentioned, Angola, Malawi, Central African Republic, we have a mixture of food insecurity, drought, economic crisis, in Central African Republic, also conflict. And these are all things that have been around for many years. And as you said, the magnitude of people really in emergency and suffering and dying is enormous. Yeah. And it takes place really forgotten from everybody. Yeah. So I think that this is very interesting and also very important conversation. My personal takeaway is that I always had, and my appetite for cooperating with institutions that are not from the humanitarian sector even increased during our conversation. I think it is high time that many sectors open up a little bit more and also are ready to progress in many ways. CARE definitely is. Martin Scott, thank you very much for your contribution, and hopefully we could do some more things together in the near future, and all the best for the release of your new book. You're certainly one a new reader and a new learner.
Thanks very much.
Here in Austria. Martin, thank you very much.
Great, thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. This was CARE in Action, the podcast of CARE Austria with Andrea Barstorff-Hager. For further information, go to care.at. Sponsored by CC Real.